Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Series 15 of Rahelastapa, stop saying that, you people down there, and it's lovely to be back. Look, hey, if you like these shows, why not come along and see them at the Leicester Square Theatre and also on tour? Go to richardherring.com/gigs and you should be able to find out. If you want to help us fund them, why not go to our new website, which is rahelastapa.co.uk, rahelastapa.co.uk. You don't have to repeat the whole thing, and you'll find out lots of info about the show. All the podcasts will be there. Also, there's a paywall and you can get behind it and find out all those behind the scenes interviews. There'll be my shows up there. There'll be lots of extra special surprises for you to have. So, and all that money will help us film these shows, which would be lovely. Anyway, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy this first episode of the new series. Let's see if it's any good. I wonder. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. It's Series 15, bitches, yeah! Please welcome a man who wears his own merchandise when he exercises at the gym. It's Richard Herring! Oh yeah, we're back. Series 15, recommissioned, it's all gone very well. The executive producers love the show. Welcome to, we've changed the name because this year we are going to be doing the podcast all over the country. So we wanted to keep the same initials. So we're experimenting with some new names. I haven't seen the one the guys have given me. Welcome to Richard Herring Love Sucking Todgers Podcast. What? But I don't love it. I'll do it. As long as they do it back. I prefer to go second. I was hanging around with the European Research Group and the other day, and Jacob Rees-Mogg, he calls it Rahelastapa, so I don't know if that's how. And he calls the European Research Group ERG, and he calls himself Durham. We're sort of a brand new world for us here at the podcast. We are now, we've moved over to Acast for this series. So you at home will be getting a few adverts, but you can go to rahelastapa.co.uk and pay some money and get ad-free versions. You're not going to, though, are you? Because you're a cunt. So stop complaining about the adverts. Either pay or shut up. Oh, you want me to do it for free? Fuck you. So hope you enjoy that, and let's see how that works out. Could probably be all right. My exciting news, as a result of the end of last series, of course, we had Terry Hall on the show, which was very exciting for me. He's absolutely one of my heroes. It was a lovely interview. There was a kind of serious bit for it in it about some bad stuff that happened to him as a kid that made it into all the newspapers because they're too lazy to bother going and finding their own stories, so they just listen to this. Hello, journalists. Welcome. I'll try and get you some stuff for you to write in your papers, shall I now? Very angry. I started very angry. what I liked about it, it was on the BBC website, and they actually just printed up one of my tweets, which is, oh, I'm very excited about Terry Hall. This is one of my heroes. They just kind of printed this tweet up, but they printed the entire tweet, and it said, now up on video, and then on audio, and then in brackets it said, video being uploaded again, because Chris Evans, not that one, uploaded the low-res version. The clot. That wouldn't happen with Captain America. And that was on the... That was without any explanation on the BBC website. Which officially means that Chris Evans, not that one, is a clot. So that is good to know. That's in the news. That made the news. That'll be the front of Wales Today. Tomorrow. What else has been going on? I was thinking the other day, a very great comic called... Bethany Black tweeted about who remembers Spangles being a poor piece of observational comedy. But who remembers the first time they saw a comedian saying, who remembers Spangles? I'm generally quite interested to work out who it was, because I've gone back through what I remember. I'm like, Spangles actually only stopped being made in 1984. And I'm sure that within a couple of years, people were doing the who remembers Spangles jokes, which seems too... That's 700 days is not enough for nostalgia to... Do you remember Spangles? No, okay. So some people don't remember Spangles, so this material is really going to go fall flat on their face. So if anyone can remember the first time at home, anyone can remember the first time they saw someone saying, who remembers Spangles? I would love to hear about that. They were brought back in about 1995 for a little while in Woolworths. Do you remember Woolworths? Which means there's a lot of people doing that joke in the mid-90s. It means there's a genuine possibility someone was asked who remembers Spangles while they were eating a Spangle. That is the worst kind of nostalgia comedy I've ever seen. Okay, it's not worked out. That was no good. And we do have this. We have a new website as well for the podcast. So if you want to find out you can donate personally and get lots of extras, including the behind-the-scenes interviews we do. Very good one with our guest today. Some of my stand-up shows, ad-free versions of this podcast, and lots more. Entry into a free draw. It's really good. Go to rahelastapur.co.uk and you can find out all about what's going on there. It's a brand new podcast, a brand new website. That's what it's called. That's the thing. Okay, so it's my first day back. Come on, give me a fucking break. So, we were going to meet our guest this week. He's been on before. I was going to say he was best known for being in the audience for the Maria Bamford Rahelastapur, but nobody knew he was there except me. But I actually then saw just now, he was also, you'll know him from Kidneys for Jesus. That's why we're here tonight. I know, because I saw a lot of recognition of that. Will you please welcome the amazing John Ronson, ladies and gentlemen? Come on, sit down. Make yourself at home. Come on in. You can have some free stickers. Oh, thank you. Take those home with you. Kidneys for Jesus?
Yeah, that was what was that? That was a documentary I made about a religious group in Australia whose leader decreed that all of his members had to give their spare kidneys to a stranger.
What if they said, I don't have one to spare? I'm not...
Well, because it says in the Bible, yeah. Luke, I believe, yes. It says, he who has two tunics should give one to he who has none. So they extrapolated that for kidneys. It turned bad. It turned very bad. It actually, like most of my stories turned bad, but this one turned especially bad. What happened was me and Dave, the leader of the group, really fell out. This story, I realise I'm building up to this being funny. Get that out of your head. It's not funny. So me and Dave fell out because I said that I thought that one or two of his more impressionable members should be given a cooling off period before donating their kidneys, which Dave did not like. So then he stopped me from filming, and then he sent me a message. There was a woman in Scotland called Christine who was on their donor list, their kidney donor list. And me and Christine had got, you know, become friends, and she really needed a kidney. Anyway, Dave sent me a message saying that Christine had taken a turn for the worse. He could instruct one of his members to give her a kidney, but if he did, I would only accuse him of manipulation. So he had decided to let Christine die.
Oh my God.
And let her death be on my conscience.
Yeah, I don't think... I don't think that cuts much mustard, does it? I don't
know.
He can try that. Is it on your conscience, Christine's death?
No, because, I mean, the funny thing was...
That you gave her your kidney, you felt so embarrassed.
This is actually, it's really interesting, because Dave was a very manipulative gentleman and was telling me like everything I was doing wrong and all the, you know, why I was bad and why, you know, and I was starting to believe it. I was really getting sucked into his kind of vortex. And when he sent me that message, it burst the bubble. I thought, oh, you're a twat. And so actually it really backfired, him sending me that message. It was too nuts. If you're going to gaslight someone, don't go full, let her death be on your conscience.
Yeah. I mean, how far does that go, though, as well? Is there any things that come in twos yet? Because you've got two hands, you could give one of your hands.
Yeah, well, kidneys, like, you can live...
I mean, you can give a hand. Well, definitely give a hand. That's as easy an operation.
Dave, to his credit,
did
give one of his kidneys.
Did he?
Yeah. Eventually. Once he was basically cornered into it by my disapproving looks.
But what if he gave his kidney to someone who was then... Did they only give him to Christians, or did they give it to anyone?
No, they would give them to like whoever...
People who didn't want them? People with two fine kidneys?
Yeah, it was a dark... I mean, it was a dark, dark story there.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that one until I just saw it on your IMDb page.
Yeah, it's not one of my more popular films, mainly because, A, it's incredibly upsetting, and, B... It has footage of people's kidneys being removed.
Yeah.
And no one wants to watch that.
No. No, I wouldn't. I'm very squeamish. I can't watch anything like that.
I tell you what I did learn, actually, with that particular story that's always stayed with me. Dave was a bad person, and I portrayed him as such.
Yeah.
And so it did nothing. Like... Here's a bad person being bad. Like, what does that do? It does nothing. So what you want to do is surprise people.
Yeah.
Take people who are demonized and show a different side to them, or vice versa. You know, turn people into what all humans actually are, which is most humans anyway, other than Dave, is a mix of positive and negative characteristics. And with that show, I couldn't do it. And that's why
you are very good at that, generally, because, like, you know, I was listening to the audiobook of The Elephant in the Room on my drive in today, and so it's only an hour and 50 minutes, so you can
That was me going to the Republican National Convention in 2016 and hanging out with my old friend Alex Jones.
Well, you're very fair to Alex. I mean, you're very nice about Alex Jones, given he's Sandy Hook denier.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I say old friend in inverted commas. I was the first person. Me, I'm kind of like Alex Jones as Simon Cowell. I basically was the first person ever to write about him.
Well, you talk about what it is, and then I'll ask you some questions.
Okay. Do people know Alex Jones other than her appearance on The One Show? No, I'm kidding. Alex Jones is now America's most nefarious conspiracy theorist. The thing that's most startling about him is that, not so much anymore, but certainly for a while, he had the ear of the president via Roger Stone, who's just been indicted. So who would have thought that Alex, who believes, you know, just ridiculous things, actually has influence now on the world stage?
Yeah, and it's your fault, because you were found him for one of your kooky books about extremists and made him famous. Well, the thing you did together made him famous.
Yeah, it was certainly how. I mean, I think it was on the way up anyway. Yeah. I did. I always think so. Me and him snuck into the secret society called Bohemian Grove. There's a secret club in the forests of Northern California called Bohemian Grove, where there's a giant owl, giant stone owl, and on the Saturday night, all the men of wealth and power, like Henry Kissinger, John Major. Clint Eastwood. They all dress up in robes and hoods and have a ceremony that culminates in a human effigy being thrown into the fiery belly of the giant owl.
Yeah.
So when I first heard that, I thought, well, that can't be true. So I phoned up David Icke, and I said, I'm thinking of sneaking into Bohemian Grove. Do you want to come? And he went, no, that's where they transform themselves back into giant reptiles. Which I honestly thought was an excuse. So then I phoned up Alex Jones, who I'd met about a year earlier at Waco. He had rebuilt David Koresh's church at Waco.
Yeah.
So I said to him, I'm thinking about sneaking into Bohemian Grove. Do you want to come? And he said, yes, I'll smuggle a camera in and we'll confront those devil-worshipping globalists going about their satanic evil. So I said, I think stealth might be a better approach. Anyway, okay, stealth. So we snuck in. Will I tell you how we snuck in?
Yeah.
It's a great story.
It is.
Okay, so Alex's plan was to rent a boat, moor it along the Russian River, which is the name of the nearby river, climb the mountain and get in that way. And so then we met this local lawyer called Rick, this kind of preppy lawyer who had himself infiltrated Bohemian Grove, because like in the various towns, like everyone's like, what the fuck goes on there? So this local lawyer had snuck in, and so we went to him for advice. So he said about Alex's plan, he said, if you're going that way, you're going to get yourself killed. So Alex got out his notepad and wrote down, going in that way, dash, killed. So,
it's worth making sure you remember that. Yeah. Something could slip your mind. Yeah.
So Rick said, no, what you need to do is dress preppy. Go to the local preppy clothes store, buy some preppy clothes, and then just go in and walk up the drive, giving the security guard a kind of I rule the world wave.
Yes.
So we went to the local Eddie Bauer preppy clothes store. It was like, do you remember Mr. Ben, the old cartoon?
Yeah.
It was like Mr. Ben. Alex went into the dressing room looking like a kind of far right-wing Texan redneck and came out looking like the Great Gatsby, in his kind of preppy clothes. And then I walked up the drive, got him. Alex changed his mind because he thought maybe like in The Wicker Man it was all part of a complicated plot and he would be the one sacrificed in front of the giant owl. So he went in via the undergrowth. And got a terrible rash, I think poison ivy.
Did he not look at his notebook saying, don't that way, you forgot about right. It's a different way in.
But he managed to get in.
Yeah.
And so we got in, we filmed the owl ceremony. And
it's so weird. I mean, the thing is, I mean, everything's weird about, I mean, this book is, I mean, it's looking at the mad state of America. But before the mad state of America that we're now in, that's been going on. What is the possible... Did you talk to anyone there? The people who went to this thing and dressed in hoods and worshipped owls.
I managed to find one person who had been to this ceremony as an invited guest who agreed to talk to me.
Yeah.
Guess who it was?
I think it was Jeremy Beadle.
No.
Oh.
It was Harry Shearer, the voice of Mr. Burns and The Simpsons, yeah.
His previous guest on this show.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Well, he had been invited to quote, when I asked him why they'd invited him, he said, I was invited to quote, Jew the place up a bit. And he...
Doesn't he play Mr. Burns in The Simpsons? You said it was full of Mr. Burns.
Well, exactly. So at one point during the interview, I said to him... I said, I wonder what Mr. Burns might think of thinking he'd do the voice. And he had no fucking way to thought. I'm really ashamed of that. I said, I wonder what Mr. Burns would say about the evening. He said, nothing. He just gave me a look to say, I'm not
I wonder
that.
What Derek Smalls would make of this, though.
But no, I think I know what the purpose of Bohemian Grove is.
What is it?
I understand the purpose. It's you know, America's a young country. So if they're going to have rituals, they need to basically just write them from scratch. So this was like a little bit of a mix of, you know, Midsummer Night's Dream and, you know, a bunch of other things. There was a guy, like, in, as part of the ritual, there was a guy wearing leaf-covered lederhosen at one point came on and started, like, singing this song about, oh, trees, oh, boughs. Oh. It's all, like, there is a weird thing about the ruling elite in probably here as well as in America that they enjoy ritual and ceremony.
Yeah.
At Skull and Bones and at Yale, they kind of lie in coffins. And at Bohemian Grove, they do that stupid owl bollocks. I tell you, like, there was Alex standing behind me, Alex Jones, with this look on his face as if to say, I am witnessing satan. And in fact, he brought out a video saying that we might have witnessed an actual human sacrifice, which we definitely didn't. As if, like, it was weird enough, fucking, anyway. Like, what?
And everyone was weeing everywhere. So, like,
they were peeing on the trees. So, like, I realised at one point, like, all these old men of wealth and power were taking it very seriously. Alex was taking it very seriously. I was the only person in the entire Redwood Forest who thought, this is fucking nuts. Like,
but it is, I mean, it's sort of unbelievable that could happen. So then if you get someone who's paranoid... as he clearly was, Alex Jones clearly was even then, and now he's obviously got much more.
Yeah.
Everything's a conspiracy. But if you're a conspiracy nut and you find out, A, there's something, and B, there's no... Why is there no security? How could you walk into the place where...
It is a little odd. I mean, there's a big conspiracy theory about how me and Alex were, like, allowed to go in and so on.
They did a different one for you.
But I don't think I made Alex a star. I think he was on the way anyway. I like to think of Bohemian Grove as being, like, Alex's revolver, and 9/11 was his Sergeant Pepper's. Okay. It was 9/11 that really made Alex.
Fair enough. Fix. I mean, but there is an element where, I mean, you do sort of joke about it, but there's an element where you're by being a reporter on it and by being so immersed in it that you are actually
lifting someone.
When you're affecting the outcome of something, you know, you're not.
Yeah, I got to say, like, of all the things I've done in all of these years, I suppose that's the one. You know what? That's the one I should feel. A little kind of nervous about, but the reason why I don't is because it would be sort of postmodern to think that I was wrong, because Alex in the late 90s wasn't the Alex of today. He wasn't a racist, and I've checked this with people who've worked with Alex for years, and I've said, look, I don't remember Alex ever being Islamophobic. And certainly he wasn't, like, you know, terrorizing the parents of children who'd been killed at Sandy Hook. So actually, when people say, oh, John Ronson, you were too nice to Alex Jones, it's not really true, because the Alex back then was, he didn't have power, his message wasn't as malevolent as it is now. You know, it was...
I mean, him building David Koresh's church back up was a clue, though, wasn't it?
Well, you know what?
We didn't give that guy enough of a chance. Bring him back.
Well, you've got to remember that, you know, a lot of people died in that church, and you could quite argue that it was government overreach that killed them and not Koresh.
Sure. But, you know, in this book, with that, again, it's very cheap little
e-book
to buy. So do buy it. It's good. It's very interesting. But Alex Jones, within Trump's presidential campaign, basically may have been bringing his supporters and him being flattered by Trump, it might have been enough for Trump to win with those people.
You can argue. I mean, Trump didn't win by that many votes. And Alex's people...
He lost
by many millions. Alex's fans aren't obvious voters.
No.
So you could argue, that Roger Stone... I mean, it was really mystifying to me, because I couldn't understand... This was obviously before Trump was elected. I couldn't understand, like, why would they make that massive gamble? Why would Trump and Roger Stone, you know, these kind of, you know, operatives who've been around the block for decades, why would they make that gamble to bring Alex Jones into the fold? I mean, surely it would, like, turn off more people than it would attract. But I was wrong and they were right.
Yeah.
It might well have tipped the balance.
Well, it's sort of... feeds into all the stuff you've been doing in the last, well, all the time, really. In a way, like them, you predicted everything that would happen, not quite 9/11, but you were saying in them, I remember reading that, and it was before there had really been any major Islamic extremism, or certainly in terms of, you know, terrorist attacks, and you were predicting that from them.
I think so. I think the thing that I kind of noticed with them that other people hadn't noticed at the time was the relationship between political and religious extremism and conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
Like, now we kind of just assume that, that, you know, extremists are into conspiracy theories. But I think that book maybe identified that for the first time.
Yeah, and I think within... But also that the way that Trump has come to power... is very much in the same era as all the things you've been doing your podcast about in the last two or three years, which you've been concentrating on pornography, which I can understand. But it's sort of the same. It's all about data. It's all about the way that the butterfly effect, which I was hoping was going to be a series about the Ashton Kutcher film, just discussing whether it could happen in real life, whether it was... And then maybe move on to Sliding Doors next and have a whole series of discussing whether that was realistic. But it's about the starting point of it's obviously things spiraling from one thing to another, hence the title. But it's the starting point is a guy in Holland, is it?
Brussels,
in Belgium, who's realised that he can, by giving free porn out to people, that he could make some money, basically.
Yes. So he basically gave the world Pornhub. I mean, Pornhub pre-existed for a couple of months before he came along, but Fabian made Pornhub, into the sort of juggernaut it is today.
Yeah.
And what is Pornhub? Pornhub is basically...
We know. They all know. Look at him. That guy hasn't been out of the house for 3 weeks. Look at him.
Well, what some people may not realise about Pornhub is that it is a repository... to a large extent, of pirated content, user-uploaded. So, as a result of that, what you had kind of overnight was a giant flow of money from the San Fernando Valley into Fabian's pocket. Fabian got so rich that he got his own aquarium, which is so big he needs a diver to come once a week to clean his coral reef. Yeah. Like, you know you're doing well when you get your own diver.
And he's got a swimming pool that's a room, and then the floor goes down.
Oh, yeah, it tips over, and then there's a swimming pool there.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I'm getting one of those.
Whereas the porn people became so poor that many of them had to go into escorting to pay the rent. Many of them have to now work three times harder to make, three times less money than they used to make. And then some other more surprising and kind of amazing consequences too.
We can talk about it a bit. I want people to listen to it, so I don't want to give too much away.
That's true. But I'm doing a big stage show as well. I'm going to be showing some of these clips.
So yeah, you're doing a tour. You're doing the Palladium.
I'm doing the London Palladium.
So is it based on the Butterfly Effect, the show, or is it the...
The Butterfly Effect, and then its sequel, The Last Days of August. Yeah. But I'll tell you one thing, which is one of my favourite bits. One of the ways that porn people are making money in the sort of post-Pornhub days is they do bespoke porn. So if you have a fetish that's so weird, that's so bizarre that nobody has ever made a porn film about it, you can now pay professional porn people to... What would yours be, Richard?
Ventriloquist dummies being wanked off by ventriloquist dummies.
Do you know what mine would be?
What?
Mine would be a porn star... whispering in my ear, it's okay, you are allowed to go to sleep at 9 p.m. all I want is an early night.
That's good too. Yeah. I'd go for that as well.
So when we discovered about the world of bespoke porn, we just got completely obsessed. This is me and my producer Lino, and started finding, getting people to send us the craziest, because what an insight into somebody's inner life is the bespoke porn film that they commissioned.
It's a good emergency question I may be asking all the guests this series.
So one thing I'm going to do on stage in this tour is show a selection of my favourite bespoke porn clips.
Yeah, no, but it's both these series are they're very engaging, they're very moving and tragic in lots and lots of ways, especially The Last Days of August. And there's lots of funny bits in there though as well. But it's very impressive. A, what you've done with podcasting. It's good to see people. I was going to ask why you chose to podcast it rather than write a book about it or do a TV show about it. Was that a conscious decision? I think I can sort of see why it would be. But
yeah, it was. I mean, you certainly don't want to do TV when it comes about porn because the act of seeing people naked or having sex is so overpowering.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to be concentrating on the human stories and the nuances and the things that that I'm interested in. So taking the visuals out of it was a really good idea.
Yeah.
I didn't write a book, partly because my American publisher was like, I don't want a book about porn. but Audible were like, cool with it.
Yeah.
I love podcasts as a listener. And
I think it's got the element as well of, I think both as a listener, but as a participant, where it's, you do open up more, I think, as, there's something about it. I think you can keep people anonymous, which you could do on a radio show, so people can give their stories and not necessarily say who they are, or you can read it out for them if they're not.
You get to know the insides of people's heads, when you spend time with people. I mean, I love these kind of long form shows. I'll tell you what's the opposite of. It's the opposite of Twitter. On Twitter, everybody's either, a magnificent hero or a sickening villain. People are reduced to this kind of stereotype on Twitter. But what podcasting shows is that, for most humans, the opposite is true. For most humans, we're an interesting mix of good and bad.
I thought that exactly that about The Last Days of August, because The Last Days of August is about that. It's about... it starts from a porn star tweeting something that people took offence at, piling on, and then this porn star commits suicide, and is that because of the tweet or whatever?
And this happened a couple of months after we left the porn world after making The Butterfly Effect, so we re-entered the porn world to try and figure out what happened to August.
And so then also then people who sent nasty tweets to her after she's committed suicide, they get the unbelievable thing of that people believe they've created a Twitter pile and caused this, and then Twitter pile onto those people.
Yeah, of course. But actually, because on Twitter, we're like, when it comes to shaming, we're like, kind of, all we can do, our imagination is so shit that all we can do is like, if somebody inappropriately shames someone, what do? We shame them. It's like we're like a clumsy builder covering cracks.
Yeah, exactly. So if they then kill themselves, people would come after you. So it's just insane. But actually, that whole series is what you should be doing with everything, which is this slow, 3.5-4 hour long examination of that subject properly, and it comes to proper conclusions. It's very admirable in lots of ways. I think you're not a sensationalist, but even though you take sensational topics.
Yes.
I like the fact that very early on you say it looks like it's going on when you say, I want to say this isn't what happens. And we're not building you up to a moment of suspense and then we're revealing at the end that this didn't happen, which is great.
When you said that about me like not being sensationalist but doing sensationalist topics sometimes, it just reminded me of how I used to really admire Nick Hornby and the way that he can finish a novel. He can make a novel climax like in the basement of a Starbucks on Upper Street. And I always thought that was such a skill, to be able to take something so small and make it so big. And I think what I do is the opposite sometimes. I take something that's huge and make it very small.
It makes it very human. So all of those people in both of these series, the people who are affected by the Ashley Madison revealing all the names of the guys who wanted to have affairs and stuff and the awful consequences of that. And this whole story, that it's... Yeah. It's the people. There's a great bit in the Last Days of August where one of the porn stars is really angry with you, and there's a very impassioned speech she basically gives you, saying you're just doing this to do this and this and this, and it's, you sort of feel a little bit for it. I mean, it's sort of one of the questions that that I know you must keep asking yourself. It's that same thing. It's about you as the journalist.
Mm.
Does your participation affect the outcome? She's saying you're going to lead. This will lead to more people being upset and more people maybe killing themselves. It's the same thing against you. You've been accused of many times. Yeah. It seems so. But that's interesting because also you're a part of it and you don't skirt that. But it's sensitive. It's about finding out these. It is that. It's that thing with. In the first series of people, that way you start that first series saying you saw someone giving a porn star a disdainful look,
Yes.
And then reveal that, you know, 750 million men in America download pornography. So there's this awful hypocrisy of human beings.
Well,
they use this stuff but are disdainful of the people who do it. And these are real, often very damaged people, I suppose.
I mean, some are, some aren't, I think is the truth of it. I should explain, you know, for people who haven't heard it. So what The Last Days of August is about is this, you know, very lovely, bubbly porn star, August Ames, was Twitter bullied, and then later that day she committed suicide. And so I spoke to her husband, Kevin, and I said, look, you know, I've just spent a year and a half in the porn world, and I wrote a book about public shaming, so, you know, maybe, you know, it feels appropriate for me to contact you if you ever want to talk. And he wrote back, and this is like a month after she died, he started naming names. He started saying, you know, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but only a little. You know, he said, you know, this person, this porn star, piled in on her. She wouldn't be dead now if it wasn't for, you know, this person and that person. And so I contacted them, the people who he was blaming for August's death, by and large. And they started saying to me, I think you need to look at August's relationship with her husband. And then this sort of cascade of rumours and gossip. People started saying, I don't think it was suicide, I think it was murder. And the porn world was kind of aflame with, you know, people blaming each other for August's death. Yeah. And I just kind of figured, well, I have to like take at least some steps to try and figure out why she died. But what I entered into was an incredible ethical minefield.
Yeah.
The likes of which I've never experienced before.
But that's, you know, but then it's so, that's what doesn't happen anymore in anything. It's like, you know, Brexit, if someone would do a 4-hour reasoned podcast about Brexit, that would be useful for people. People just make up their minds either side and then argue. And this, you know, the journey you have to go on and the worries you have, you feel it's going one way, then it goes another way. But actually, you know, I think you do solve it, you know, really.
I think so.
Which is great. Also, a lot of these podcasts, you think, oh, this is going somewhere, and it just, there's no conclusion, there's no answers to anything. And I think that you do
find
the essence
of
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is an incredible thing, achievement over something like that. But I think it's that fair, you know, you're fair to people, you're aware, you're an interesting journalist. I think, again, in the Alex Jones one, you were quite, you know, you're quite angry with journalists as well. So whilst Alex Jones...
Oh, yeah, no, there was a moment at the Republican convention, I completely forgot this, where, like, everyone was, like, you know, hoping there'd be some, like, violence, and there just wasn't any. And somebody said to me, there's going to be a flag burning. And so I was like, somebody's going to burn the flag. And then, like, honestly, I have never seen, like, there was, like, 1,000 journalists came running to, like, the side of the road where this, you know, woman was going to set fire to the American flag and protest against Trump. And the journalists were, like, so, like, excited that finally there was some action to film. They got too close and she accidentally set fire to her trousers. So here's a woman with, like, her trousers are on fire. And then all of the crowd start panicking and everyone's like kind of running around and panicking. I'm right up against this chain link fence at the back. And I'm thinking, if I get crushed to death now, it's not because of the alt-right. I'm going to be crushed to death because of some drama-starved fucking journalists.
They're all playing into the hands of Trump. It's so fascinating.
Oh, you know, I don't know if this is a well-known fact or not, but this was the moment when I thought Trump was going to win. This was in May 2016, so this was a couple of months before he got the nomination, and it was such a portent. I was at the gym, and on one of the screens was Hillary, who was being very inauthentic. And then they cut away from Hillary, not to a Trump speech, they cut away from her to the empty podium from which Trump would eventually speak.
Right.
And I thought, fuck, we are fucked.
Yeah.
We're fucked for so many reasons. We're fucked because, you know, the media is just in love with this sort of extraordinariness of Trump. And Hillary's not doing well, you know, she's I mean, she may be a great person, but she's not coming over as authentic on TV. I just thought, we're fucked.
Yeah.
And we were.
We were, but it's the same thing that runs through. I mean, I'm not blaming you for all of it, but it's the same thing that runs through all your work is the conspiracy theories, you know, and that becoming into the mainstream. It's like those Alex Jones supporters saying to you, you know, 20 years ago, people were taking the piss out of me, and now look, everyone's agrees with the things I've said. The way that they could take a story and just go, I'm not saying this, but, you know, maybe this is what happened.
Yeah.
And that kind of propaganda element. But it's, again, it's the same as the guy, the porn guy, understanding how data worked, which the porn guys making the money at that time in California didn't understand how data worked. And YouTube is just the Pornhub is just YouTube of porn, so it's not it would have happened, someone would have come up with that idea.
Someone would have done it.
But it was being the first person to come up with that idea of uploading porn, making your money in advertising and other ways.
It's funny, the porn world's, you know, famously always been at the forefront of technological advances. So, like, you know, 8mm, VHSs, you know, these things were really driven by porn. But when it came to, you know, the YouTube for porn, they were way behind.
Yeah.
It wasn't the porn world that invented Pornhub. It was these, you know, tech bros up in, you know, Brussels and Montreal.
Well, there's an element
who'd never set foot on a porn set.
It's the same with music as well. So there's a complacency and there was a suspicion, and therefore, you know, well, we don't want to give our money, this stuff away for free because how will we make money? And then it's the people who realise how you would make millions and millions of dollars. What's amazing about porn is that people are still making it. If people didn't make it, the guy who runs Pornhub has got nothing to put up. So they could hold him to ransom, but he knows they can't because someone else will make it. So
yeah, it's true.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So, but I think it's the same with, it just sort of all coalesced as I was listening to these podcasts of that. That Trump kind of understood data, the whole, and the Brexit people understood data and the power of data.
Yep.
And that's why the world is where it is now.
Absolutely.
And the understanding that people are, you know, malleable in this way.
You know, the moment it really hit me, like the importance of search engine optimization and algorithms and so on, it was when I was on the set of Stepdaughter Cheerleader Orgy. And the director I had quite a few epiphanies on the set of Stepdaughter Cheerleader Orgy. One epiphany. Can I tell you all of my epiphanies?
Yeah, please do. I mean, I want to talk about being on porn sets, obviously, so we'll get on to that after the serious bit.
Well, one of the epiphanies was the director, Mike Quasar, who's a real veteran, he's been doing it since the 90s, hates, I mean, it, honestly, right, like, I can tell you right now, he is shooting porn now. All Mike Quasar ever does is shoot porn. Like, if he's not asleep, he's shooting porn, and he hates it. He said to me one day in a sort of, you know, just a moment of sadness and self-loathing, he said, you know, I spend my life framing men's ball sacks out of shot. To which I said, like why? And he said, oh, it's apparently in porn,
It's off-putting, I would say. But that's the reason I think I don't take
that. So that's Mike's life. So Mike hates porn. Wants to just, you know, to hate sex, I'm sure. And but that's his life. He's trapped. Anyway, he said to me, you know, in the old days, our films weren't called things like Stepdaughter Cheerleader or G. And I said, what were they called? And he said, well, the very first porn film I ever made was called Women of Influence. And he said that, and then the one after that, he said, was called The Billionaire's Blonde. And he said, the reason why this film is called Stepdaughter Cheerleader Orgy is because it's like a kind of arms race of search engine optimization. We're desperately trying to see what the most searched for porn terms are. Stepdaughter, cheerleader, and orgy being three of them. And then we make films that are kind of tailored to that. So that's why.
What do you think the appeal of stepdaughter porn is? Because my computer is like full of it. Not my downloaded, just if I'm trying to watch porn, I don't want to imagine having sex with my wife's other daughter.
Yeah, you know, step. the most searched for porn term in the world, by far, I believe, is step.
So what's the appeal of what's the fuck is going on with the world? Well, you know what?
I always thought. Well, I didn't always go any knew this about a year ago.
I was like, I'd love to have a stepsister so I'll get banger.
I assumed it's because everybody other than us has a proclivity to incest.
Right.
But actually, so I said that on stage one time, and then someone tweeted me from Reddit.
Right.
And said, actually, that's not necessarily the case. They said, like in stepbrother and stepsister porn, I'm just telling you what this person tweeted me.
Yeah.
They said the performers tend to be better looking. So, I don't know. This isn't my... I don't know.
So it's the performers are more attractive. That way. I'm not doing this scene unless I'm your stepbrother, not your brother.
But, you know,
that would be sick.
Well, okay. So the question is, why? Because step is by far the most searched for. Stepfather, stepmother, stepdaughter, stepbrother, stepsister.
I find it off-putting. I've said before, I can work with it, but I just have to imagine the actors playing the part of stepbrother and stepsister. I don't get off on the idea of them being related to
There's one of two possible solutions, right?
Yeah.
Either many millions of people are secretly wishing they could be incestuous or not.
I mean, a lot of the things that happen in pornography, even if you enjoy them, you wouldn't necessarily want to do them. So a lot of it's about transgressing laws, isn't
hence
it? Transgressing social boundaries.
Yeah, hence the fact that I think in S&M, like I asked a dominatrix this question once, and she confirmed what I suspected, which is that like the masochists in an S&M scenario are quite often quite powerful, important people in the real world, and the sadists in the S&M scenario are quite often sort of, you know, weaker, more introverted people. So you do the opposite in that scenario to how you feel you are in the real world.
Yeah, I guess, I hope so. But the world is, you know, I wonder if the human race is going to sort of get over itself, because the world of porn shows one side of things, and the Ashley Madison thing shows millions and millions of mainly men, I think, have signed up for an adultery site, whether they were having adultery or not. So you've got
almost
this
all of them weren't.
Yeah, they weren't. Yeah.
No, because it was like 95% men and 5%, and most of the women were bots.
Yeah, that'll do for me though. I'm happy with that. Better in
the
way.
Thing I remember most about that Ashley Madison story was this incredible thing. This is really the origin story for my whole 3 years, you know, wanting to tell stories set inside the porn world. It was this girl called Dakota, and I met her at a church school in New Orleans when I was researching the Ashley Madison story, and she was part of this like circle of like, it was like a kind of confessional circle where people were confessing the things that they were most ashamed of. And her shameful secret, she said, was that she watched Pornhub. So I said to her afterwards, like, so, you know, how did you get so into Pornhub, like, that you would learn the performers' names? And she said, no, said, I never learnt their names. It's like when you kill a deer, you don't name it because then you can't eat it. So, but she was being like self... She was being self-aware when she said that. Yeah. Like, what she was saying was, I have to not be curious about the lives of the porn people, because if I'm curious about them, it'll make me feel bad about myself.
Well, that's the whole thing, isn't it? Because that's the problem with the work you do. And Louis did some as well, where he went on porn sets.
I think actually,
you suddenly see those people as real people, and that's the problem. You can't see the porn performers as real people with real problems and like real mental problems and drug addictions and stuff, because then
unless feel
that's
like,
your kink, that's going to put you off what's going on.
Absolutely. So as a consequence, the incuriousness of the outside world then allows exploitation to flourish. It allows tech bros to come in and take all their money. It's the fault of the hypocritical bystanders.
So the human race. And that's, you know, I just remember, if in the 1990s, if you're doing something mildly, you thought, oh, this is a bit perverted, I better never tell anyone what I've done.
Right.
And then if the internet comes along, and go, oh, fine. No, I'm fine. Yeah. That's fine, you know. Being teabagged is quite normal, apparently, as it turns out. But, you know, so it's you know, I thought I'd invented that. But, you know, that's the thing, is we lived in this idea that you could go, oh, we have to behave in this way and blah, blah, blah. And the internet just shows that the vast majority of people, at least in their imaginations, are not behaving in that way. Mm. So the vast majority of people at least fantasize about being unfaithful to their partners, or the vast majority of
men.
Yeah,
you know, one of the darkest things I discovered while researching the Ashley Madison thing was when most people sign up for Ashley Madison. God, in my job, you really find... really sad things. The spikes for membership for Ashley Madison, which for people don't know is a website where you can have an affair, they're always like Monday mornings, they're after the Christmas period, they're always after times that you've spent time with your with your partner.
That's when it gets to me. But, you know, those people who did, so they released all the... Someone trying to make money, really, wasn't it, I suppose, rather than genuinely shame people. But they got all the data and all the names of all the users of Ashley Madison and said they'd release them unless they got some money.
It wasn't money thereafter. They said they'd release them unless Ashley Madison, like, closed
down. Okay, so it was, that's right. So it was like a moral stance.
Yeah.
But obviously this, then by revealing the names, they created havoc and people committed suicide, or
most social scientists would tell you that that violence is always worse when it's done for a moral purpose.
Yes.
And such was the case with Ashley Madison, with the hack, that, you know, they had this sort of moral zeal to release these millions of names. So they did, and this, you know, church minister in New Orleans was caught up in it, and he committed suicide. And of course, you know, I assume anyway, there's no remorse on behalf of the hackers, because we constantly trick ourselves into not feeling bad about the bad things that we do.
Weird, but that hypocrisy and that weirdness just keeps on coming up with all of these subjects of this people judging other people, which is what the whole social media thing has become. It's just become about judgment. No, you know, and that's what I find unbelievable, is that, you know, everyone's done something in their life that they would go, I'm ashamed of that choice I made when I was 17 or whatever it was. And so if you're going to have that level, I think it was Jesus who said, judge not lest you be judged, John. Yeah. I'm not saying I'm Jesus, but, you know, I sort of get what that guy was on about now. It just seems self-defeating, because if you pile in on someone for... even like having an affair, you know, you find out other people's reasons for having affairs is because they're, you know, a woman's husband's very ill and doesn't have sex with her, and, you know, they don't have that kind of relationship. So that's not your business. You know, that's not your business.
When we pile in on people on Twitter, as we all do all the time, we are doing the thing that we are most terrified might one day happen to us. Yeah, I was thinking the other day, like, somebody said to me, like, why are you on Twitter? Someone tweeted me the other day, like, you're on Twitter for the dog videos, aren't you? And I said, no, I'm on Instagram for the dog videos. I'm on Twitter. By the way, you know the worst thing about... I think I'm the only person who gets anxious about this. You know, Instagram videos of skydivers that stop before the parachute opens? Freaks the fuck out of me, because it's like they're going to... I mean, you have to assume they're not just going to plummet to the ground. Anyone who puts a parachuting or skydiving video on Instagram really needs to cut after the parachute opens.
Or at least them on the ground going.
Yeah. So I'm on Instagram. I'm on Instagram for the dog videos, and I thought, well, what am I on Twitter for? And I realised what I'm on Twitter for is to relive that moment that I had about 20 years ago when I was in the countryside and I saw an electrified fence, like a cattle fence, and I spent ages wondering whether or not I should touch it.
I've got those very near my house, and when I every day I walk my dog.
Have you ever touched one?
No, I haven't done it yet. My dog's been electrocuted, though, so they do work. Sometimes she didn't go ever do it again. Doesn't go through the fences again, so, you know, they work.
I'm having terrible power imbalance issues with my dog at the moment.
Yeah.
She's really sensing my vulnerability and pulling me. I've got a massive scar on my hand because she pulled me into undergrowth, and I got terrible whiplash. This was like last week. And she's a very... I'm kind of going off her. She's got all the power. I want to be on a level playing field with Jose. Like, I'm not comfortable with the whole leash thing, the whole master, it's like, because it's like master slave, like, I don't want
now, because of your obsession with pornography, it's turned how much on Pornhub.
I don't want that, but then if I give Josie too much power, she massively takes advantage. So I don't know what to do. It's a problem.
Well, I'm all right with the dog, it's the kids that do it to me. So there we go. So the kids have me under their thumb. Let's talk about hanging around on porn sets and how that is as a human man who presumably has looked at pornography for non-professional reasons.
So what's it like being on a porn set? The very first porn set I went on was actually before I did The Butterfly Effect. It was when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and it was a porn set called Public Disgrace. And my big memory of that, I had two big memories of it. One was that people kept coming up to me and rubbing my back to make sure I was feeling okay and not too intimidated.
Okay.
And I think you know you're getting old when people considerately rub your back on a porn set.
That might be just how they get people involved in the porn, John. It's just like, he likes this, let's go a bit further.
And then my other memory was just how long that shoot dragged on for, hours and hours. And by 2 a.m. I was thinking, just please ejaculate so I can go to sleep. And I realised I'm probably millions of women before me.
Is it not thrilling? Is it something you'd like to join in
it
with?
It becomes very unsexual very quickly.
Yeah.
So after my Public Disgrace experience, I then basically embedded myself with my producer, Lena, on Mike Quasar sets. It's a very unerotic experience. It really is. It really is. I never quite worked. Nobody ever told me. Nobody ever sat me down and said, "Here's the etiquette." You don't watch, or you do watch. Yeah. No one ever told me that. I had to figure it out for myself.
Right. Which is it?
I think the answer is you don't watch.
Okay.
You don't watch. You go off and into one of the. They're always in rented mansions in the San Fernando Valley. Right. There's always lots of other rooms you can go and sit in.
Right.
So you tend to go off and sit in other rooms.
Yeah. I sit on my own in rooms when I'm watching porn as well. It's best. But it's exciting if, you know, don't lock the door just so there's that frisson.
Yeah.
You might get walked in on. what feels amazing about the internet, and there is so much positive stuff about the internet. And no, this is just the way the world has always run. A new thing comes along and takes over, and the old thing gets. You've got to be the person who can see what's going. You should be an entrepreneur because you seem to see everything coming. But it's changed so much. It's so revolutionary, and in such a short amount of time that it makes the world feel very unstable. I mean, you're talking about the effect on young people because you and I are about the same age. We would have found a magazine under a bush in a wood with a bear lady and having a hairy muff and taken that home and looked at it and been confused.
Yes.
And that would have been, our pre-19
And now,
you know, kids, you know, so I've got my kids are luckily not that age yet, but you were aware that the age is getting younger and younger, that those kids are going to see.
Yeah, I think most kids start watching Pornhub around the age of like 11 or 12.
Yeah.
So it's basically, Pornhub is sex education for the world's children
and
nowadays.
And that's not good, is it? Because it's not good. Sex education, because that's not what sex is.
No, exactly. And as a consequence, erectile dysfunction. And you know, I've had people double check this. This is a controversial study, but I've had other people sort of check it. And, you know, I think we can pretty much establish that it's probably true. The erectile dysfunction in 18 to 25 year old men has gone up since the advent of Pornhub by 1,000%.
Right.
Shot through the roof or not.
So, yeah, but then also just giving people an unrealistic idea of relationships and, you know, and if you.
Yeah.
I mean, you see how people are affected by traumas in their childhood or weird things happening in their childhood or just unusual things happening in their childhood and that impacting their adult lives, which again is runs through all of this stuff.
Mm.
And so if kids are seeing that's their first, you know, that's this is your introduction to what sex is, it's got to like have a massive effect on the psyche of the world. You know?
Yeah, I'm sure. One unexpected consequence is that the San Fernando Valley, like in the 90s, if you wanted to get into porn, you knew what you were getting into, right? It was like you knew you were Bonnie and Clyde. You knew that this was you deciding to be an outlaw. But that's not the case these days because, like, so many, you know, kids grow up on Pornhub that by the time they get to 18, they think that's a viable career option. So the Valley is flooded with 18-year-olds trying to make it in porn in an unprecedented way. And what are the consequences of that? One of the main consequences is that they all get to shoot. Like the few remaining production companies haven't been closed down by Pornhub. They all shoot. Like some new girl comes into town. She gets work, you know, constantly for like 3 or 4 weeks, and then that's it. It's over. Like the companies, unless she gets signed by one of the big agents, like Mark Spiegler. That's it. Her career's over. So there's now. So what does she do then? She either goes back to where she came from and gets a different job, and she becomes a high school teacher. And then for the rest of her life, she has to worry that somebody's going to find out that she did porn, which is much more likely that she's going to get found out now because, you know, these days, because it's right there on Pornhub as opposed to like going into a DVD store. So that's one negative consequence. Or you go into escorting. You know, if you want to stay in the Valley, you end up being an escort. So, yeah, that's another consequence of the tech takeover of porn.
Yeah, it's
not great.
It's not good. Well, it sort of makes you fear for the world. I mean, I just don't know whether... Is this going to be, like... I mean, the whole the internet thing, the nastiness, the you know, the lying, the fake news thing, is this just going to be a blip and we work out some way to get around it?
Yeah.
Are people going to go, hey, look... Let's be reasonable people again and not just attack someone for having a different view to me or for doing something wrong. Let's go back to the world where we gave people... You know, people make a mistake of any kind. So, like, pornography is, like, an almost extreme example of that, that can affect the rest of your life.
Yeah, but people making a liberal joke that comes out badly, which is full of, you know, what my book about public shaming was about.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope that we've, you know, with the election of Trump particularly... It's like, okay, we've touched the stove now and we know that it's burning hot and we don't want to, you know, so I'm hoping that people, we've seen the consequences of what we've done because I'm convinced that Trump is a consequence of all of us. Like we all polluted the waters and then Trump emerged from the polluted waters like kind of mutant fish.
It's sort of incredible. Even a year before, really, but if you'd gone to someone 20 years before and said, this guy is going to do this, and still be elected president, you would have just, you would have thought it was absolutely impossible.
I saw a tweet the other day when somebody said, if you told me that we would have a president who sleeps with porn stars and wants to create a space force, and yes, I still hate him. I hope it's because it's not like we all know. I mean, we pretend on Twitter that our fellow humans deserve to be defined by a tiny little slither of their lives, some poorly worded tweet.
Yeah.
But we know that's not true about us. You know, we know that's not true because we know ourselves. You know, we know ourselves that we are a mix of clever and stupid. We do good things, we do bad things. Like, we know that's true. So why are we finding it so hard to realise that's also true of our fellow humans if we know it's true of ourselves?
Well, it's something about, I mean, it is something about the economic times and all this sort of stuff, isn't it? It's the, but that's the problem. We've got this vacuum of you know, politics and poverty and economic failure at the same time as all this is happening. It just sort of feels, you know, it could be apocalyptic, is what I want to say. And instead,
well, I think, you know, the way to for everyone to do their bit, I think, you know, 100,000 people screaming at one person is not democracy. I think the way for people to do their part is if they see a kind of ambiguous shaming unfold, one that you're feeling a little bit uneasy about yourself, chime in, because voices going back and forward, discussing things, that's democracy.
Yeah. Well, it is, and that's what, I mean, that's where, that's one person. One person agrees with you, and that's democracy, so we can now discount that. Yeah. But it is, and that, but it's just that the time, you know, the time, just a little bit of time taken. That's what I really think that the last days of August does show that you know, it was and everyone initially blamed a guy who tweeted about take a cyanide pill, a horrible tweet, but the in fact she'd commit suicide before that tweet even came out. So these, if you just start to investigate and think about it, and then, you know, and take some time and some understanding of people.
Twitter is the world's worst information swapping service. Yeah. We're constantly getting it wrong. 48 hours later, we realise that the person we just destroyed, we got the facts wrong. Well, I'll give you one example. Does anyone remember the... I mean, these things happen so often now. You know, we destroy someone and then just, you know, carry on whistling down the streets. But there was a woman not so long ago who was like the aunt from hell. Her orphaned 10-year-old nephew. Does anyone remember this story? Jumps into her arms... Auntie, like, jumps into her arms, breaks her wrist.
Right.
So he's orphaned, and she sues him.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So that's bad, right? But that's so bad, and everybody destroyed her. But that's so bad that actually what people should have stopped and thought was, like, no one's that bad. And the true, you know, the truth of that story we discovered 48 hours later is because the American healthcare system is so fucked up. And I live there now, so I experience it. You realise some people pay more in healthcare than they do in tax, most people in America. That's how bad that's how bad it is. What had happened was because, you know, to qualify for some kind of health insurance for her broken wrist, the wording in the insurance claim led a journalist who didn't quite know what they were talking about to think that the woman was suing her nephew. But it was all bullshit. And yet, we just all leapt in, destroyed her. 48 hours later, when we realised we got it all wrong, did we self-reflect? No, of course we fucking didn't. We just carried on and destroyed someone else.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about the last day of August is just the way that you have to wade through people's motivation for saying what they're saying, their self-preservation, their self-delusion. And so it takes a lot, you know, there's a lot of, oh, someone said this has happened, so it's happened. And that's the problem, that we don't seem to have that. Well, should we think about it? Should we listen to the other person's side of the story first? Or
yeah, God, it was hard. The last days of August was a very, very hard show to do because, you know, I didn't realise that that was the story that I was stepping into, the story about trying to figure out, you know, why this person died and whether the people around her. It was very hard because what I had to do, I had to accurately, you know, the responsibility that I gave myself this last year was to kind of accurately try and figure out why August died. But to do that, you have to start questioning the motives of her grieving, you know, of the people who were close to her.
Yeah, of course.
So how do you do that? You know, how can you be accurate about why August died while at the same time be sensitive and compassionate and empathetic towards the people around her? And Jesus, I mean, it was like it was just a it was a night. It was, you know,
it's a really beautiful thing. It's phenomenal. It's just really exciting that podcasting can have that scope. And I think it is something that I don't think you could have done in any other medium, certainly with that level of control. Needed you to be at the centre. I think your producer is fantastic as well.
Lena Mesitsis. Yeah. She's brilliant. Yeah. She embedded herself in the porn world for like about 2 years. I was on about 6 porn sets. She was on 100.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's do listen to both these series and go and see John on tour. Where, is it going all over the UK? Is it the
pretty
world?
Much. It's quite a big one. It's God, I can't remember, but it's like most major cities. It's in May.
JohnRonson.com?
Yeah, JohnRonson.com.
Yeah.
Without no H in John.
No.
And click on upcoming talks and you'll see the whole thing. It's a big tour. It's like the London Palladium and the Cambridge Forum and Vicar Street in Dublin. Some great venues I did last time around on my Psychopaths show, Newcastle Tyne Theatre, and so on.
Great. Well, do go and check out that show. Do check out the podcast and give it up for the fantastic John Ronson, ladies and gentlemen. Not bad.
Thank you, Richard.
You have been listening to Rahulastapar with me, Rich Herring, and my guest, John Ronson. The music is, as always, by Pest. I'd like to thank everyone at Leicester Square Theatre, everyone at Go Past the Stripe, including our fantastic team who filmed this show for us as well. Thank you to everyone at Acast. Thank you. I'm indebted, as always, to my producer, Ben Walker. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFastTheStripe.com production. And do head to rahulastapar.co.uk if you want to find out more about the podcast and if you want to give us some monthly money in return for loads of extra goodies and a chance to win a massive prize draw every month. It's very exciting. Go on, have a look.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. GoFastTheStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.